Welcome back to Nocturnal Journal on WGN 720. That's the 1954 chess version of Muddy Waters. I'm ready, as requested by our next guest, our longtime friend who's never been on the show, Bill Dahl.
Been a pleasure to be here. That's amazing.
Bill, I've known you for, what, 63, 64 years?
At
something
least.
Like that. Seriously, like the only Entertainer, maybe. So when
we first met, yes.
Yeah, you were writing for the Entertainer.
As were you.
Yeah, you were writing a lot more, though.
I was trying. I needed the money back.
That was it. Yeah. And Dave Crane from Dave's Records is going to join us because we're going to be talking about, this is a fantastic book.
Thank you very much.
And I probably didn't know about it until I went to Logan Hardware and I saw it there.
The Art of the Blues.
The Art of the Blues by Bill Dahl with art consultant Chris James, a visual treasury of black music's golden age. It's a coffee table size book of... Well, not just album covers, but sheet music and stuff. And tell us about the time frame, how you chose to pick the time frame for the book.
Well, it took about a year altogether from start to finish. Chris James, who's a wonderful blues guitar player out in San Diego, used to live here along with his playing partner Patrick Rinn, who's on bass. He was really the man who came up with a lot of those images. He probably owned 65 to 70% of it. Then he brought his friends in. They contributed some images too. Very little of that is my stuff. There's a few album covers in the last chapter. But we have everything in there from posters, 78 label scans from both the pre-war and post-war years, 8x10s, which is my personal passion. We have album covers. Both from the 50s, 60s, and 70s, early 70s. Got magazines. My favorite chapter, I think, is one of the pre-war ads from the Baltimore Afro-American and the Chicago Defender, which have some amazing artwork and really give you insight as to what was going on back in the 20s and 30s as far as how they marketed 78s by bluesmen back in those days. Some of them are pretty outrageous.
You picked the time period of the 1920s to the early 70s as the time frame for the book. Why was that?
Didn't want to go any later. First of all, stuff from after that, I can come into Dave's store and buy it. So what do you need a picture of in the book for? Secondly,
absolutely.
It just doesn't interest me. I got to be honest. I'm a classic era guy or whatever you want to call it. Yeah, I review a lot of contemporary blues stuff and everything, but it's just not the same as the stuff back in those days.
Where did the idea for this come about?
There's a company over in England called Elephant Books. They're what's known as a book packager, and they contacted me about writing it. Then the University of Chicago Press picked it up after it was finished, and they published it.
Now, I'm going to go back into some specific stuff on the Defender, but tell me, and the listeners, I mean, you've got such a rich history in blues journalism here. Tell us how that started and what all you've done.
Well, I started writing at the Illinois Entertainer. Actually, that was my first shot in the late 70s. An editor we both remember named Guy Arnson.
I love Guy.
As do I.
Yeah.
He's the guy that thought I had...
I just picked up an Entertainer the other day. He's still on the masthead.
I'm glad to hear that. He actually
Do you know Guy, Dave?
I might know him, but I don't know him by his name, no.
Back then, and I don't know what's popped into my head. I remember I reviewed a Plasmatics album for Guy, and they would pay you. This was common. They'd pay you by getting to keep the album.
Yep. That was, and you know, it's kind of come back to that in recent years for magazines I write
for.
Is
it really?
Yeah. For a while there, you actually got paid pretty well, and then it's all just kind of gone off the other end, and now it's back to free CDs. So Guy gave me my first shot in the late 70s there, and I got to interview people like Albert Collins and Muddy Waters, so I was on cloud nine there, and kind of took it into the liner note thing in the mid-80s. Of course, I wrote from 90 to 97, for a newspaper that happens to be in the same building as we're in now, freelance for the Tribune. And not as much newspaper, not as much magazine stuff now, obviously. Not even as many liner notes. There for a while, I was doing 50 to 100 a year. Boy, those days are over, let me tell you.
Yeah, tell us some of the big liner notes you've done. Didn't you get Grammy nominated for?
I did in 98. I wrote one essay of many in a Ray Charles box set. There were like six or seven people, all of them infinitely better known than yours truly, who were in there. You know, Ahmet Erdogan, Jerry Wexler, Billy Vera, and Bill Dahl. But it got me to the Grammys in 98, which was the year of the Bob Dylan soy bomb incident, which I still recall quite vividly. And, we've done countless, you know. The stuff I think I'm proudest of isn't blues. It was a complete Motown singles box set series. There were 14 of them, every A and B side in the history of Motown from 59 to 72 on like 80 or 85 CDs. It was outrageous. And I co-wrote those, and boy, am I proud of that.
How did you get to be such a completist in your research and in your writing for things like this?
OCD, possibly?
Yeah,
I
really,
don't know.
Really, really?
I don't know. I like collecting. I had that bug. When I was three, I was collecting records. My uncle was a jukebox king of Decatur, Illinois.
I didn't know that.
No, he wasn't connected. Don't get the wrong idea. But he started giving me all these old shot 45s that were too far gone to be on the box anymore. So I heard Fats Domino and Jerry Lee Lewis and Elvis and Lloyd Price and the Coasters and the Drifters. And kept on buying a little at a time, learned a little more, mid-60s, Chuck Berry, Roy Orbison. Started going to high school in 1970, right up the road here at a place called Wonderful High School, Metro High School. Yeah. What did I do with my lunch money? Bought records.
You did.
It seemed like there were 1,000 record stores in the Loop back in those days. Every dime store, every department store, there were all these little indie stores, stuff like in little tiny hole in the walls. And I'd go into all of them, and I'd just spread around that lunch money.
Do you remember that time, Dave?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. What was that like?
When I first started buying in LaGrange, I mean, a lot of, like, you'd buy records at Polk Brothers, you'd buy them at the Jewel, you'd buy them, you know, every little hole in the wall everywhere had records somehow.
First album I ever bought was at R&G Food Mart at the corner of Lawrence and Paulinus.
But was there in these stores, I mean, how was the blues inventory? Were there a lot of blues records?
There was, you know, in the cutout racks, like in Montgomery Ward's, which doesn't exist anymore, Gold Blast. It was incredible. They had all these cutouts for $1.98 a pop.
So right, they had no idea what it was. I mean, they just probably bulk bought stuff that other people didn't want or didn't know what it was, and they had no idea what it was, so it'd just be in a bin, and you'd be like, oh, my God.
And I'd go there every single day, or every single week at least. I'd make the rounds going, did they get anything new? And, yeah, they got something new. So I'd be all excited and start grabbing stuff, and that's how I learned. I went from rock and roll of the 50s to, let's say, soul or B.B. King, Freddie King, Albert King, then the Muddy Waters, Lightnin' Hopkins. I just, you know, got into it more and more as time went on. So by the mid-70s, I loved it all.
So they knew about you, so that's how this book came about. They kind of found you.
Right. They were aware of who I was and everything and kind of took it from there. They kicked around some other ideas for books that didn't really take off, and then this one came up, and it seemed like a good idea. And the first thing they had me write in that book was that piece about Don Bronstein.
Okay, yeah, from Playboy. Yeah, talk about him, Chess and Playboy.
Yeah, he led a double life in a way. He was Chess Records' main art director, took a lot of the album covers back in the 60s, but his main gig was as the Playboy art director. So I think he kind of crossed those paths a lot of times because, like, there was a whole series of oldies albums in the early 60s with buxom ladies on the front cover. They're called, like, Remember the Oldies, Oldies and Hi-Fi. Those are probably some of the ladies from the Playboy roles there.
Sex sells.
Yeah, and now... this is radio, but people might have these records at home. I mean, the Clarence Henry, where you always hurt the one you love. He's sitting on a park bench with his hand in his head. You know,
I bought that album.
That's out of your collection.
That's my personal album, Second Floor Rose Records over on Wabash, for $1. Never forget. I thought the album cover was so weird, I almost didn't buy it because I couldn't figure out what it was exactly. I sort of knew who Frogman Henry was. It's a picture of a guy out in, I assume, Lincoln Park, sitting on a park bench with his head in his hands as his girl walks away with another man.
Yeah, and she's even kind of looking at him. Like,
yeah, saucily. The album cover is called You Always Hurt the One You Love.
And Down and Out Blues by Sonny Boy Williamson was something of a homeless person or a down and out person on the cover. Now, I'm passing this over to Dave because we were talking before we went on the air. Here you have black people on the cover with blues records. Motown wasn't doing some of that stuff, were they?
They didn't early on. They'd either use drawings. They did with the Miracles. They had album covers with the Miracles. But a lot of them, like the Marvelettes, unknown reasons. I mean, well, known reasons. They wanted to sell them down south. They wanted to put them in the rack jobs down south, like in the drugstores, the dime stores. And unfortunately, album racks were as segregated as the place itself. So they would do that. A lot of albums. VJ, right here in Chicago, did a ton of that. Jerry Butler albums. A lot of them have. You know, I remember,
what's the Impressions one? No, the Impressions were all pushing the car.
That's later on.
That's later on. Yeah, right. Yeah.
But the VJ stuff, I remember right up the road here in the next block, right there south of Wacker on Michigan, I was looking at a D. Clark album and had this squeaky clean photo of two white people on the front cover, like in a college setting. And I thought, oh man, this can't be the same D. Clark I've heard. And I almost put it back, but then I decided to buy it anyway. And you know what? It was the same guy.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
They just didn't want to put him on the album cover, sadly.
And when did that change?
Mid-60s. I think the last time Motown did it was on that Isley Brothers album, This Old Heart of Mine, maybe 65. After that, finally the walls came down and we didn't have to have the cavorting white folks on the front of the album covers anymore.
The Art of the Blues. You got to get this book, A Visual Treasury of Black Music's Golden Age by Bill Dahl. It's the University of Chicago Press. 224 pages, 350 color plates. Really awesome. So tell us more about Don. I mean, what did you learn about? You said that was the first chapter you wrote. Mm-hmm. How did his life at Playboy, this is a great Chicago story, how did his life at Playboy parallel what he was doing at Chess?
He was good at both. I mean, I think Playboy probably was the lion's share of his work, you know, but Chess kept him busy. As, you know, it's funny you brought up that Impressions album because that was another Don Bronstein. He did stuff for ABC, Paramount, a lot of labels he worked for, several of those I'm pretty sure at least a couple of those Impressions albums were his. I don't know if he took the pictures all the time, but at least he did the artwork on them. But, you know, until I interviewed a gentleman on the South Side not 2 years ago named Jay Jordan, who was a singer, turned out Don Bronstein was his manager. And I learned more about him from Jay than I ever did because there's very little about him anywhere.
Well, what was the deal? Your book says that he drowned in Mexico or something.
Yes.
What happened there?
There isn't much about that either. Jay told me about that. He drowned in Mexico, and he left Jay an antique gun in his will.
Really?
Yeah. And that was, I mean, that's more than anybody knows. It's strange that this guy is not lionized because he did so much artwork for so many great album covers all the way back to that Little Walter one in 57, the best of Little Walter. The striking artwork.
What did you learn? I mean, you know so much, Bill. What did you learn from doing this book and doing the research that you didn't know before?
Well, golly, I learned how hard it is to put together a book like that for starters.
Yeah, right.
A lot of work, a lot of work.
It is.
A lot of intensity there, but especially about the pre-war stuff, because Chris James is a pre-war fanatic, and I never really knew that much about that, the 78s from the pre-war era, the rarity, the insane rarity. You know, Tommy Johnson 78 was made in 1929. I think there's only two or three of them left. I believe it sold for something like 37,800, something like that recently. That's a lot of change for a platter.
Okay, we're going to take a break for some spots. We're going to come back. I want to go back to the Defender chapter too, because there's some real interesting things about migration in here I want to talk about. So don't go away on WGN's Nocturnal Journal.
Have you ever loved a woman so much you tremble in pain? Yes, have you ever loved a woman so much you tremble in pain?
Welcome back to Nocturnal Journal on WGN 720. We're here with our guest Bill Dahl, the author of The Art of the Blues, A Visual Treasury of Black Music's Golden Age, and Dave Crane of Dave's Records at 2604 North Clark Street. Do you get a lot of people? He's talking about, Bill's talking about 78s and 40s. You get a lot of rare blues stuff coming in your store?
The rare, I was talking with Bill about this. The blues stuff doesn't come through like it used to come through. I mean, back when I started in, you know, 85, and you would run across that stuff because it was a lot more common. There was people changing over their collections, going to all CDs and getting rid of stuff. And but nowadays, a lot of that stuff, it's being bought out of the country, number one. It's all going to Japan, or it's going to, you know, Germany, or, you know, a lot of foreign buyers buying that stuff. So it doesn't circulate around quite like it used to. But we do still, you know, run across it, not quite as frequently as we used to.
Do you still find, Bill, do you still go out record digging and stuff? The last time I found some really cool stuff, and lately I've been into collecting, besides my supper club music, is weird civil rights gospel type stuff. So I go to Out of the Past out there on the west side.
Sure, I've been there.
Yeah. Are there still places like that in Chicago?
Not very many, truthfully. I remember looking through some of those 78s with a couple buddies of mine. Man, they were gray. They were literally gray. They've been playing so many times. And
at Out of the Past or something?
Yeah, they're still snapping them up.
Yeah. I mean, Out of the Past. Have you been there, Dave?
Honestly, that's one I've never been to.
Yeah.
I've heard about it.
Huge.
But I've never been.
Huge.
There. Yeah.
Huge. But a lot of stuff's not in the best condition. But it's 4800-something West Madison or something?
Yes.
Yeah. So there's nothing like that on the South Side anymore?
I don't have a car, truthfully, so I don't go out. And, you know, places I go to tend to be the same ones, you know, go to now and then. But mostly I buy CDs, truthfully. I like 45s still. I mean, I just don't. I'm slowly selling, like Dave says, I'm slowly selling off my albums too, but very slowly, little at a time, little at a time.
A little at a time.
When I get it on CD, I tend to get rid of the album because there's only so much room in a three-room apartment. And when you got all those CDs, there's not much room left for Bill to live. So,
now tell us about the Defender chapter, and I what you put in there. And I just some of the images. I found it fascinating just from the migratory story. I'm going up country, Chicago bound, but sung by Papa Eggshell. You know what I mean?
Yep.
Wonderful Ida Cox sings Chicago Bound Blues, the famous migration blues. So tell us about this chapter, and of course, how important the Defender was.
Extremely important, you know, because they disseminated the newspaper on the trains that went south. There were a lot more stops on what we know as the City of New Orleans route back in those days through every little burg in Mississippi, and so they would bring copies, the Pullman porters would bring copies of the newspapers and drop them off in segregated areas where they otherwise wouldn't see this. And there was always ads in there during the late 20s, early 30s for these 78s that were coming out. There were only 10 or 12 labels probably actively putting out a lot of product in those days, OK and Columbia and RCA, a few other ones. And so they were to advertise their wares. And the ads, which we have some in the book, are these wonderful kind of, sort of like that Frogman Henry album, only they're drawings. And they're kind of, you know, it's kind of a visual idea of what the song is about, or at least to some crazy art person thought the song was about. My favorite's Blind Lemon Jefferson, where he's riding the cannonball playing a guitar. I always wonder what happened when he landed, but poor Blind Lemon. There's another one that's not in there where he's laying in a bed covered in snakes. They did terrible things to Blind Lemon in those drawings, I'll tell you. But the Defender was very important in that, you know, in that regard, and so was the Baltimore Afro-American, which a lot of those ads also came from.
You say here the Defender was reportedly the first African-American newspaper to publish a detailed entertainment section.
Yes.
So that's where a lot of these ads ran.
And that's why a lot of people knew all the clubs in Chicago even before they came up from the South. They knew what was swinging.
Did you guys ever think of doing a playlist for this book? Something on Spotify? I mean, you could almost follow the book musically. You
know? I think we're both so Luddites deep down that I don't even know how that we'd know how to do that. Chris probably would, but I'm just about this much computer literate, you know. I can send in my articles. That's about it.
It's really a fascinating book. Where can people find it? I know they can find it at Logan Hardware. That's where I saw it.
Yes, I've seen it at Barnes & Noble. I've seen it at the 57th Street Bookstore on the South Side. Up by the University of Chicago, which makes a lot of sense. It's all over.
Okay. In the time we have left, I'm thumbing through the book. I know I earmarked it, but tell us about the Roy Milton label. I love the artwork on that.
Those are another example of
here it is.
Illustrations of the songs they're in.
And did you see this, Dave?
No, I didn't.
This stuff is great. Roy Milton Record Company and the Miltone label. So tell us about Roy Milton, first of all, who he was and who did that artwork.
Roy led a band called the Solid Cinders out in Los Angeles. They had a lot of hits, R.M. Blues being the biggest, of course. He was a drummer, singing drummer. Had a wonderful piano player named Camille Howard. Little Jump Blues combo back in the mid-40s. Then he had that label called Miltone Records. And they hired a guy named William Alexander to do those little drawings right on the 78 labels. I actually saw a real one down in St. Louis when I was looking for
some 78s. I'd love to get one of those.
There's one in a bin down there in St. Louis at a record store called Euclid for $10.
Is it really?
Yeah.
I go to Euclid. Yeah.
Euclid's a great store.
Yeah, yeah.
I said, hey, look at that. It's a real live Milton.
Well, you say in the book, I mean, they're just beautiful pieces of art, but they really didn't translate into record sales for them.
No, that label only lasted about a year, and then he was on Specialty, which was just starting out, but it was already doing better.
That's where I got to know him. Yeah. He was on Specialty.
And he just stayed on Specialty after that. But he didn't do all the songs himself. There are a lot of other artists on there, too. And we have a spread of 9 of them in the book. And it's pretty impressive to see all these, because they're very kind of, I don't know, artsy, you know, cute little images of, like, women and men, you know. Then nothing raunchy. Don't get the wrong idea. But, you know, just
you wouldn't do that. I know.
Like a guy
raunchy guy.
Kind of like the Frogman Henry thing. Woman walking away from a guy. I think there's one in there called Sunny Side of the Street, and it's like she's crossing over the sunny side of the street, leaving the old guy behind to go to the new guy.
What a great – this turned out really good. Yes, an hour of talking about this type of stuff. So thanks, Bill Dahl. The Art of the Blues, A Visual Treasury of Black Music's Golden Age, University of Chicago Press. Is there a website?
Well,
www.press. uchicago.edu.
That's
Does
true.
That sound right?
That's it. Or you can look at my own website, which is just BillDahl.com. I worked real hard to come up with that.
Okay. And Dave Crane, thank you.
And that's how
well, anything
I,
else new at Dave's?
My coming up with a name for the store, Dave's Records. Simple as that.
And give us the address and a website for you guys.
It's 2604 North Clark. Look us up on Facebook at Dave's Record Chicago or on Twitter at Dave's Record Chi or our Instagram. You'll find us. All the kids find us. Ask your kids. And if you're not, older and can do it too, that's all cool too.